It's time to get organized this new year with Menards. Update your closet system and add style today with Closet Culture. Choose from two closet finishes and four colors of shelf boards to create a functional yet stylish closet solution that matches your home decor. Check out all our Closet Culture closet kits or view our weekly flyer on Menards.com to see all the great deals happening now.
Save big money at Menards.
Hi, I'm Shauna Meyerson with the Yoga of War podcast, here today with NGO watchdog, Dr. Gerald Steinberg. If you appreciate and find value in these important discussions, please consider supporting the show so I can continue to bring you such amazing and esteemed guests. Details are pinned in the comments below. In the years leading up to October 7th, 2023, as you may know, I led monthly Yoga Athletic Cause fundraisers for a wide variety of international causes. What you don't know is that every month I had to do extensive research into every potential charity to make sure that they didn't have an anti-Israel agenda in the Middle East. Almost every single one did. In fact, sometimes I had to go with an NGO that was just sort of anti-Israel, just for the sake of having someone, anyone, who could help in a particular humanitarian emergency. You see, anti-Israel agendas are nothing new in the NGO world. They've just become particularly toxic. These past weeks, an intricate and deeply disturbing strategy to sabotage the Jewish state under the auspices of international aid is finally fully being exposed, thanks largely to Gerald Steinberg's organization, NGO Monitor, and their scathing report on how Hamas infiltrated many of the world's most prominent international NGOs and has used them as weapons in their propaganda war against Israel. Gerald Steinberg is founder and president of the NGO Monitor Research Institute and professor emeritus of international relations at Bar-Ilan University. He has been involved in numerous academic and governmental advisory frameworks, including the Israeli Foreign Ministry and the Interparliamentary, there's no L-Y in there, Coalition for Combating Antisemitism. His latest academic publication, co-authored with Anne Hertzberg, is reputationable. What is it with me and the extra syllables today? Well, I've been in Israel too long. I don't remember how to speak something. English.
Blame it on jet lag.
Reputational risk blamed on jet lag and workarounds. Documenting UK funding to Hamas-linked entities in November 2025. And his essays have been published in the Wall Street Journal, Financial Times, among many other media platforms, and he was awarded the prestigious Bernard Lewis Prize in 2025. Woo, I stumbled through that.
Well, you got it all out.
I'm telling you, jet lag is not my friend. I've not been sleeping for the last few days. Besides, Tel Aviv is the nonstop city.
That's it, so you've got a combination, double whammy.
I get it all. So let's start out. So you founded NGO Monitor in 2001.
2001, 2002.
Okay. And most people, even those who are deeply ensconced in this war, are only now becoming aware of the depths of the corruption within the social justice movement. Can you take us back to 2001 and share what you saw then that people are only waking up to now?
Let me take one step back before I get specifically into what hit me pretty hard over the head at the end of 2001 and then led me within the months that followed to start looking at this issue of NGOs seriously. I call the NGO world an industry because it's massive, something that I didn't understand when I got into this. I thought, okay, I'm going to look at a few particularly problematic organizations, spend maybe 3 years. I'm an academic. I can do this. I'll write some papers, get some graduate students, teach a course, and that would be, I'd go back to what I was doing before.
Whoops.
But it's like archaeology. You start to dig, and it just goes deeper and deeper and deeper. So it's a multi-billion dollar industry with essentially no oversight, no checks and balances, and has this reputation, as you talked about at the beginning, of being filled with people who are largely activated with very good intentions. They're altruistic. The image that many people that I run into have is these are volunteers. Mm-hmm. The concept that this is a multi-billion dollar industry with massive salaries and benefits and all the infighting and all the corruption that comes with a big industry that has essentially no oversight, no checks and balances, is something that has been carefully hidden. We call it in many ways the halo effect. Well, you can't criticize us. We're Amnesty International. We're Doctors Without Borders. There's an infinite number of organizations like this. And just to let you know, it's just as a order of magnitude, the organization Doctors Without Borders, highly regarded, all of those things, has an annual budget of $2.2 billion
wow.
a year. Yeah.
That's more than the GDP of a lot of countries.
Well, it's way up there. Oxfam, I've forgotten. I think Oxfam is half a billion, but it might be more. These organizations have a lot of stuff. The people who run them want to make sure they maintain what they're doing, maintain their perks, maintain everything. It beats working for a living in a lot of ways. But that's really the overall motivation. And then the way in which they use and abuse this freedom that they have, this and the reputation they have, the halo effect, and the fact that there's really nobody who's checking out what they're doing, and they've become very heavily invested in agendas which are very strongly part of the demonization of Israel, part of the sanctification of Hamas, terrorism, all of that goes together. And nobody had really looked into that. And that's something that struck me. In 2001, there was a United Nations conference that was held in Durban, South Africa. It was in the end of August, early September. It was to celebrate the end of apartheid, the freedom for Nelson Mandela, and also to what they said was to create a framework, a working plan for the complete, this is their language, elimination of racism and xenophobia, and there's other words that were tacked on to that. It was no less than this complete elimination of racism in various forms. And we have the example of South Africa to follow. But in the process of preparing this conference, over a number of years, it was kidnapped, it was hijacked by NGOs, particularly working closely with Palestinians, pro-Palestinian groups and countries. They held their major, what was called a preparatory conference, in that great bastion of freedom of everything in Tehran. Really, today, definitely resonates. And that's where the agenda of focusing on Israel, of demonizing Israel, of using terms, this was 2001.
Yeah.
Their final declaration included the accusations, the statements. It wasn't, let's go check this out. Israel is guilty of apartheid, ethnic cleansing, and collective punishment, war crimes, and genocide. That was 24 and a half years ago. Everybody back in the last couple of years when the term genocide was being used and marketed almost like a commodity in the most corrupt and most trivial way as part of the war to prevent Israel from defending its own people after October 7th. And a lot of people who were upset by that thought this was something new that had just came up. But it's been part of the NGO political warfare advocacy since Durban for over 24 years. They've just continued to take this package and expand it and enhance it and amplify it and use it. And then when October 7th happened, they just pulled it. It was all ready to be pulled out.
Sure.
Even before any Israeli troops went into Gaza, here comes starvation, here comes genocide. we're going to make sure this doesn't happen. We're going to push the agenda of completely isolating Israel. And that is the continuity. And that's really, I didn't realize at the time that I was going to be still dealing with these issues and working with some amazingly talented and motivated people to try to expose this. But here we are. That's what we're doing. So that's a short history.
Okay. I'm going to ask you a short question. It's going to be a hard
answer.
My answers
are always long. I'm an academic.
That's okay. So for the audience, why Israel? So we have, not for you, but why Israel? Yeah. So Durban has this conference that's meant to eradicate hate and racism. It becomes a Jew-hating, Israel-hating, Zionist-hating festival. We have, 194 countries, I think, in the United Nations. Why Israel? And why was Durban the place that this was inevitably going to surface?
Okay, this is a 14-week course.
That's right.
But I'm going to try to do it relatively shortly and briefly, and go back before Durban, before 2001. Okay. Durban didn't come out of nowhere. It was definitely well prepared. I'll hit a couple of high points, not necessarily in chronological order.
Okay.
But let's start with the 1975 United Nations General Assembly resolution. Some of us are old enough to remember that.
Yes.
Declaring Zionism as racism. The question of why Israel, why Zionism in 2001 at Durban is the same question of why Israel, why Zionism back in 1975. And then that was a 10-year buildup led by the Soviet Union and very much what was then called the Arab League. Now it's more the Organization of Islamic Cooperation. Now there are 55 countries in the United Nations that are members of the Organization of Islamic Cooperation.
Mm-hmm.
The Arab League was less, but in those days there were a lot less members in the UN. So between the Soviet bloc and its satellites, some of many in Africa and Asia and elsewhere, and the Arab League, they had a majority in the United Nations already in 1975.
Sure.
And what did they want to use this majority for? Not to increase their economic capabilities, not to promote world peace, and everything that goes with that when we think of the United Nations. But the goal there was, again, the isolation, the demonization, the war against Israel.
Let me interrupt here for one second, because from what I understand, and I'm not a professor, and I'm not old enough to remember, because I was four, but I know it happened. From what I was told, that this, what we would call now Red-Green Alliance, formed because they wanted to overcome the United States' grip on the United Nations. So just to sort of clarify what you're saying, was Israel perceived as the soft underbelly of America, so to speak, or do you feel like this really was about Israel, i.e. the Jews? Because that's the only thing that distinguishes Israel from every other country. I mean, many things.
You
but.
Said or. I'm going to say and.
Okay.
Yes, you have this what's called post-colonialism ideology. Yes. It goes back, I'm really older, the Vietnam War.
Okay.
And a lot of the people who came into the NGO world, people like Ken Roth, who ran Human Rights Watch for almost 30 years, had a combination of both elements in that was driving him. So, and he brought lots of other people with him, but both the opposition to the United States, to democracy, to capitalism, to all of those
horrible things.
Yeah, exactly. Which were so prominent in the 1960s and definitely expanded as a result of the Vietnam War. And academics write these long books, and there's a guy named Edward Said.
Mm-hmm.
And this is where it comes together.
Yeah.
See, the two pieces are not separate. That the anti-Westernism, Edward Said wrote a book called Orientalism, and it was really the birth of what we call post-colonialism. The West is responsible for objectifying, conquering, colonializing, terrorizing, destroying the cultures of the global South.
Mm-hmm.
They're good guys and bad guys.
Right.
And the good guys are, and then the NGOs bought into that. The Soviet Union was very much, in many ways, there's a really excellent researcher, Isabella Taborovsky, who has traced, among others, but she in particular, traced the way in which the Soviet propaganda, anti-US, but also very much anti-Semitic. Stalin in the 50s, his predecessors in the 60s and 70s, gave birth and really fostered this post-colonial ideology. Mm-hmm. So what you see is a combination in different venues, universities, NGOs, the United Nations all together, saying in parallel, United States is evil, it's the leader of in the West and democracy. They're all guilty of the worst terrible crimes of colonializing the world. And anti-Israel, anti-Zionism, where you have Professor Edward Said, a professor of English at Columbia University, who becomes the guru and merges these two things together. Said is a very virulent anti-Israel activist. He's not a Palestinian. He claimed to be Palestinian, and it was problematic where he was born in Egypt. We won't go into all that. But he adopted this personality and very, very popular. And his works are still, he's treated like a saint in Columbia and Harvard and all the other universities. So you have this combination of factors that were percolating. The Soviet Union also had a very strong anti-Semitic strand to it. They didn't, and when Israel became allied with the United States, also in the 60s, the United States began, there was difficulty, but around before and after the 67 war, the United States began to sell weapons for the first time to Israel. It was the first time we could talk about an American-Israeli alliance. The Soviets were very upset by that, and as among a number of things, and they saw Israel as an easy target to go after. And there was a strong element of anti-Semitism. Some of it was historic religious anti-Semitism. Russia is very infamous for that. Mm-hmm. A lot of Europe, Eastern Europe is, but Russia in particular, the history of anti-Semitism was strong. So Stalin and his successors built on all these factors together. And there's some amazing movies and images, videos, which Isabella Taborovsky has uncovered of festivals being held in various places like Cuba and elsewhere, bringing in this is in the 60s and 70s, the heroes of the struggle against imperialism. And you have people like Arafat,
right?
And you have Angela Davis, and they're all together. Intersectionality wasn't born 10 years ago on university campuses. It was back there. It was part of the Soviet strategy to undermine the West, undermine the United States, and anti-Israel propaganda, support for the poor Palestinians who are the representatives of the suffering victims of colonialism. We won't get into the history or non-history of Palestinians. They became the most visible and embraced symbol of this global South victims of colonialism who could never be accused of committing war crimes.
Right.
Or other terrible things because they're by definition victims.
Right.
So this goes back to the 60s.
Okay.
So then we get to 1975. I told you it was going to be a long answer. We get to 1975 where it really gets expressed as Zionism is racism,
right.
But it's been building up before that. And then, Soviet Union falls apart, 1990. The Zionism is racism resolution is rescinded. Mm-hmm. In 1991, NGOs adopt them.
How did the pieces fall into place for the overturning of the Zion? And by the way, most people in the UN still haven't gotten the memo that resolution has been overturned, by the way.
Well, because
they still act as if it's an actual resolution, not just a concept.
I'm not sure that because there's the money that goes to promote that whole agenda.
Yeah.
That was adopted at the same time in 1975, a different resolution, has not been rescinded. But the actual resolution was rescinded in 1991 because that was the era when Saddam Hussein had invaded Kuwait.
Uh-huh.
There was an international coalition. Saddam thought he could break it apart by attacking Israel with missiles. This was back in 91. We all sat with our little kids with gas masks already in 1991, and we heard the missiles, not very many. And the United States, it's a long story, but part of the package of building a coalition, Israel said, well, we have to rescind that resolution. It was rescinded. But it was, again, the money to maintain that campaign much of which was allocated to NGOs, and the activity of the NGOs only was increased despite the rescinding of that resolution. So it didn't really make much of a difference. But the point I wanted to make was the Soviet Union was gone. The whole Soviet Empire was gone. That whole foundation of this coalition that makes Zionism racism and then led to Durban was taken over by NGOs. It was Human Rights Watch. Human Rights Watch, no, I got to throw in the money once in a while just to make it clear that we're not talking about a small bunch of volunteers doing altruistic work. $100 million a year. Their salaries are enormous. Their perks are great. They get lots of political visibility. They never have to run for office. That's why Ken Roth became the symbol, the father of this entire NGO industry, because it was he ran for election once in New York, lost, but found that at the same time NGOs were a way you can have all this power and political influence without having to run for office. So people like that created this industry, $100 million for human a year. $100 million a year, not billions, but Amnesty International, very parallel in the UK, has a budget of about almost 400 million euros a year. That's a huge, you add these all up. And I said Oxfam, Doctoral Reporters, all of that. So they picked it up from the Soviet Empire. They, when Moscow faded as the center of this campaign, which isolates Israel, demonizes Israel, uses allegations of racism and human rights violations and then genocide, that was adopted by the NGOs. For them, it is very much part of their core business. Mm-hmm. And I can explain that a little bit more if you want me to.
Well, I want to focus on your puppet regime report, but before we start, because there's so much skepticism, and as soon as you say there's anti-Semitic bias in the NGO world or the United Nations, right? The godfather of all kind and humanitarian organizations on earth. Immediately everybody accuses you of, of the oppression Olympics and so the question I get all the time. So you're saying that the entire United Nations or fill in the blank or Doctors Without Borders or whatever, name
yeah, all those
Oxfam, I'll go down the list.
I thought I would look at 10 organizations. Yeah. We now monitor 300 and we don't even scratch the surface.
Right. And so how do you respond? How do we overcome? This is more than a halo effect. This is like a God effect. These people, like most people in the world, believe that all of these organizations are the epitome of kindness, of morality. So If there is, and I agree with you that there is, a severe anti-Semitism problem in these organizations, I know we can't get rid of the halo effect. How do we get people to even listen to what we have to say when it's us, the Jews that everyone hates, because it's a loop, right? They created the hatred versus them, the greatest people on earth.
Yeah, that's... at this point, my tendency is to give up and say, as some people say to me, you're never going to change it. You're just tilting at windmills. A colleague of mine, an academic colleague of mine yesterday made that comment to me. And slightly in tongue in cheek, but look, you've hit the hardest question, one I try to avoid, because otherwise, I think, first of all, you have to try. It's so accusing the one Jewish state after October 7th, before, but especially after October 7th, and I'm not going to go through all the atrocities and everything else that happened, of genocide, of starvation, of all those, and that's Holocaust inversion. Mm-hmm. All of those things is so evil that I can't, as an academic and someone who has, the luxury of being able to choose what I want to focus on. Mm-hmm. I want to make a difference here, and not just I, but the people that I work with. How do you do that? There are a number of different tactics, and the different times different things work. I'm not saying anything is optimal at all. I wouldn't be still doing this 25 years later. But I think there are a number of things that do begin to resonate. And you said that people are now waking up to it. So facts count.
Yes.
When I talk to journalists, ones who still talk to me, New York Times journalist a few years ago got a Human Rights Watch report. It was Israel's committing apartheid. And Amnesty International, they all did the same thing. And the next day there was an article in the New York Times. They got embargoed copies. And I asked, it's a 200 and something page tome with hundreds of footnotes. And I said, I try to, you know, we divide it up into chapters. Each person took a chapter, takes a half a day to read and look and examine the claims. How did you, New York Times reporter, how were you able to absorb all this in such a, and check to see if it's accurate? Because we found lots of mistakes, not just minor mistakes. And we found all sorts of blatant lies. And the reporter said, well, he didn't say it exactly this way, but they get a summary, they get a press release, they get a one-pager, and that becomes the article on the front page. Israel accused of genocide by a highly respected human rights organization finds Israel's guilty of apartheid or genocide, whatever the reports are. So part of it is to say, and it is gradually making some inroads to say to these more serious journalists, or ones who want to appear to be serious, start with the journalists, but then we go to other academics and others. Unless you've read the report, how can you endure it? How can you give it a fair summary, a reasonable summary? And as cynical as I am, I still think that there are some honest professionals who take that seriously. And that I think we're getting more visibility on that, a greater sense of willingness to look at the material. I'll just give you one example of how difficult but how important this is. I started doing this, we said, in 2002, essentially, after Durban, by the time I got my act together. And then I got, somebody said, here, you better hire an assistant, and started to have a website. Two or three years later, as it became worse, and the Durban agenda began to be implemented against Israel, and there were reports after reports, I come back to Human Rights Watch, because that was sort of the main focus at the beginning, because they were in the United States, they were visible, and they were really bad, they were evil, and blatantly. And I began to write reports, and then NGO wanted to hire a couple of people, we increased the reports, and I sent them to the founder, I knew someone who knew the founder of Human Rights Watch, a guy named Bob Bernstein, who was in his late 70s, lived in New York. And I was in New York, doing some talks about this issue, and he said he was willing to give me 5 minutes because his mutual friend, somebody that I knew, said that it was important for him to hear me out. We sat for 5 minutes, and then we sat for another 10, and he said, I got to look at the, I left him some materials, I'll take a look at this. It was very hard for him, and it's true for many people in these circles, but especially for him as founder. It took another couple of years, and then he wrote an op-ed in the New York Times denouncing the organization that he founded and the people that now head it, Rights Something Rather Lost in the Middle East. And it said, this organization has abandoned the principles for which it was founded. And I, as the founder, thought when I went to Moscow and came back and said, these people, we need to support human rights of human rights, and they're now called defenders, but they were people who were being jailed and oppressed, harassed for speaking out for freedom, including Soviet Jews. So he said, this organization, which I founded, he had left as head of the organization, has abandoned its founding principles and turned Israel into a pariah state. So it took 3 or 4 years to get through, and I'm not saying that everybody's like that, and lots of different people, but that's an example. I still think that good people can see, go beyond all of the masks, Wizard of Oz, everything behind the curtain, and see how what's really going on. And there's a lot more to that story, but those are the basic points to it. And we've seen that. I'll just add one other important aspect to this. In the last, since October 7th, we've started to see whistleblowers come out of the organizations. And boy, are they hated. I'm hated but they're even hated more because they can say, well, what does he know? But he's just an academic. He's a Zionist. He's Israelis. But these are people, not all of whom are Zionists, not all of whom are Israelis, not all of whom are Jewish. A woman by the name of Daniela Haas worked for 13 years as senior editor in Human Rights Watch, has spoken and written about the anti-Semitism, the double standards, the hatred that drives many people in Human Rights Watch. It's harder for the people who donate to Human Rights Watch, who sit on the board of Human Rights Watch, who work for Human Rights Watch, to continue what they're doing and erase her. And there are people in Amnesty now that have come out and done something similar. In Doctors Without Borders, we see more of this. So I think that's another aspect that is a factor that can change the way that these organizations are allowed and continue to violate their fundamental principles and get away with it.
I'm curious about your choice of the word drives. You said that it is what drives them through their work. And so I'm wondering, in almost a chicken and egg scenario, like I remember recently hearing that either Ilhan Omar or Rashida Tlaib, they're the same person to me, got into politics specifically because of the Palestinian issue. When you're saying that these people are literally driven by their hatred of Israel, is this what motivates them to get into the space? Or are you saying that it's what colors their work in the space?
First of all, if it's a lucrative business, you get elected, you can get access to federal funds through NGOs, different kinds of NGOs. It's a double, the two parallel incentives and that's true also in the NGO business. Ken Roth is an amazing fundraiser. And he also got money from a corrupt Saudi businessman. He had people who helped him, Sarah Leah Whitson and others. There are reports, the documents that claim that Qatar gave him money. So far, those are still hidden.
What year are you talking right now?
We're talking about Qatar. Oh, we're talking about, Qatar, we're talking about, I think, about 2017, but they refer to an additional amount. The Saudi, corrupt Saudi businessman was 2009 or 10. The evidence didn't come out till 2020. They hid it. That's also part of the NGO world that they project this image of being full of morality and openness and democracy and all good sorts of values, progressive values, but all sorts of stuff is hidden under the table. And their board is very much supposed to be watchdogs, but they're part of the whole corrupt business. And that's a real serious issue across NGOs. The people who were, and they're driven by different factors. So you talk about people who are Palestinians, like Tlaib in the United States and elsewhere. And there the hatred goes back to, there's a religious hatred. Ayaan Hirsi Ali has written a lot about the anti-Semitism. It's just this core hatred of Jews because they're Jews. That kids are taught a large parts of the Islamic world. I really recommend people read her books because it's first person, it's entirely credible, and it's so white. And you see it on campuses and everywhere else now. I'm a Palestinian, I'm a Muslim, Israel is automatically evil. I don't hate Jews, but if they're Zionists, I hate them. And if they're Jews who act as Jews, then I also hate them, but I'm not. I know I've learned not to say it that way. That's really what we're seeing and hearing. And that drives a lot of this. And it hasn't changed. 1948, huge embarrassment. October 7th, October 8th, 9th, and up to now is also a source of embarrassment and shame. It's an honor-shame society, as Professor Richard Landis has written and others, that the shame of these Jews defeated us. Yeah, the Jews live now in this land that we call Palestine and they call the land of Israel, which we refuse to acknowledge. That's deeply embedded and it gets translated across the board into these NGOs.
Yeah.
So you have someone in Human Rights Watch now, their Palestine-Israel director is someone named Omar Shakir, an American, but with the same Middle Eastern background. And he's more articulate, more careful. But when you ask what drives him and people around him, that's a significant part of it. It doesn't explain white people who have Western backgrounds, mm-hmm. including people who are Jewish progressives that are also active in these NGOs. I keep coming back to Ken Roth as sort of the archetype, but he's got a group of other around him, Reed Brody and many others that come from this. And that gets back to the post-colonialism. And I think in some cases, probably deeply personal issues that get expressed in terms of hostility towards it all. I'm not a psychologist. I don't know anything about Ken Roth's youth, his relationship with his parents. I do know that he often trots out his father's experience as a refugee from Nazi Germany as having led him to become active in the human rights field.
Right.
And to me, that's a version I've written about this. He's actually quoted this and tried to refute it in his, what I call his pseudo-autobiography, that he uses that in a lot of ways. He inverts the Holocaust. Mm-hmm. Now it's the Jews who are committing these terrible crimes. I don't know what his father thought about the fact that his experience growing up as a kid in Hitler's Germany, and he left, I think, before 38, so he's not a survivor. Mm-hmm. But to use that constantly as a shield, I can't be accused of being anti-Israel because my father left Germany as a child. But then how do you explain this deep personal hostility that he has towards anything resembling Jewish self-assertion?
The danger is twofold. One is that it claims to assert some sort of legitimacy, but at the same time, it claims to speak for Jewish people or Holocaust survivors. Just Gabor Mate is another one, and Mini Mate, Aaron, they do the same thing. But because I know your time is limited and because it's so relevant, I want to get into the findings of this puppet regime report, because the findings are much more nefarious than what you're right now. We're talking about sentiments, but there are some truly evil elements to these humanitarian NGOs that are coming to light. We saw it with the arrest of the 9 people in Italy. We saw yesterday Doctors Without Borders. We had the uncovered. I don't know how much your organization has to do with these. I'm going to guess a lot, because your report came out and then all of a sudden the dominoes start falling, and Israel says we need lists of saying who exactly is in your employ, which they're refusing to why should we tell you?
And we don't even know. We don't check to see if they're terrorists or not. That's really what's going on. But go ahead. I'll give a more structured, thoughtful answer.
So let's talk about some of these astounding findings that you uncovered. And before we do, because everyone will always question the source, especially if it's a Jewish source and you're Jewish and I'm Jewish, and so therefore we are not credible sources. Israel, Jewish, not a credible source. So let's talk about the sourcing so that people can at least hopefully listen to what you have to say, and then the broader findings, and maybe we can dig into that a little bit.
When we've been talking up until now, as you said, about anti-Semitism and advocacy and the Israeli-Palestinian or Israeli-Arab conflict. Mm-hmm. We haven't been talking about terror because it didn't seem to be an element in this. This is, I won't say as surprising to me as it is to you, but we saw it coming over the last few years, not 25 years ago, that as the war in Gaza progressed. I mean, we had a series of wars. Mm-hmm, we had a small one in 2000, the end of 2008. There were 3 or 4, but obviously October 7th is a whole different order of magnitude. And to take this more seriously, a number of things showed up, and then that led to this much broader exposure of close terror links to humanitarian aid NGOs in particular. Gaza was prepared. Hamas prepared this war very well. You have to give them credit for that. The leaders of Gaza, Sinwar in particular, they covered all of Gaza with tunnels underneath. They built 400 or 500 miles, maybe less, maybe 400 miles and 500, whatever it is, kilometers.
Longer than the London Underground, from what I'm told.
Huge network. Yeah. Where did they get the concrete and all the wiring and all the air conditioning and all everything else that they had there and the communications? These were all used for warfare. They were used for terror. The IDF just uncovered, I think, a two-mile-long tunnel. Uncovered yesterday. So it's been over 2 years of very intense warfare, and we're still uncovering and destroying branches of this tunnel system.
And just so we don't leave this on the rhetorical level, why don't we explain?
Where did they get all the materials from? And how do they build this tunnel system if you have dozens of international humanitarian workers throughout Gaza? They knew about this. We're getting more and more reports of, like people from Doctors Without Borders, journalists in the hospitals said, 5 years ago, I was in one of the Gaza hospitals, did a report, and there were big, heavy doors. We weren't allowed to go beyond them. And somebody said, yeah, that's for Hamas. Okay? And we don't go there. Yeah, we knew there were, that's what all these humanitarian aid NGO officials basically said. We're not going to ask questions. That's right. Not our business. We provide aid. And that's really what they say. So then we began to see more and more evidence of blindness. That's different than we're right in the middle of all this. And then during the war, the IDF captured massive amounts of documentation from Hamas. And some of it in printed form, a lot of it on computers. It's interesting, they kept these records and they didn't destroy them. Maybe they didn't have a chance to destroy them. Or I think they thought they would survive long enough to rebuild, because they survived all the other rounds since 2008. So why wouldn't they survive this one? The documents showed, these are in Arabic, that every NGO, every humanitarian aid group had...
Sorry, I have to stop you. Every, define. Literally every... Or just the ones that you're monitoring, or?
No. First of all, we're not talking about the ones we're monitoring. We're talking about what's documented by Hamas.
Okay.
Their policy, their strategy, and it was essential to them to make sure that every foreign-based entity, humanitarian aid entity, UN organizations, and NGOs had what they called a guarantor. They had a Hamas person inside the organization, reporting to them and directing, telling the organization, we need 20,000 kits for some X. We need 20,000 kits of this. You got a shipment of 50,000. We need 20,000. Okay, here's 20,000. Now, that's a little bit, that's an exaggeration. That's not what's in the documents precisely. Mm-hmm. What's in the documents in each NGO... The name of the person, we didn't publish the names. I just have to add, the IDF found these documents, and they took out literally truckloads. Some of them, a lot of them in digital form, which means that you have a hard disk which you can then examine the data on it. So some of this material has been made public, and we noted very early on that a lot of it had to do with NGO relations.
Mm. Mm-hmm.
So we translated that. We have an Arabic speaker with a military background as part of our staff.
Okay.
And he translated the documents, and not Google translated, not some AI.
Right.
He went through each document.
Wow.
And they were pretty much according to a standard template. They recorded the minutes of the meetings, what was the name of the people who took place, what the NGO respond, how the NGO responded, what they agreed to do, and not all of them agreed to everything, but they all knew this was all going on and they were part of the system. And then it was a classic case of a totalitarian regime imposing itself and using every potential tool for manipulation. So-and-so is the Gary, it works for this organ, works for Oxfam, or actually it was the Norwegian Refugee Council.
Yes.
In one of the documents. Norwegian Refugee Council is also a giant based in, and their philosophy, Jan Engeland, who was the head of it, goes around the world saying, you cannot restrict NGOs and prevent it from doing their work in areas controlled by terrorists. No oversight. Our job is to help people. And that's what we do. No restrictions.
Okay.
No cooperation with governments on anti-terrorism. And so the one of the people that's described in this document that works with Norwegian Refugee Council has compromising photos on her phone.
Okay.
Which can be used.
Sure.
I've forgotten the exact text afterwards, but you can fill in the blanks. Manipulation. They kept files on every single organization and person and used that in order to extract, some voluntarily, some had to use these types of manipulation. This is like the Stasi worked in East Germany, or how all of these secret police work in totalitarian countries. Because Hamas ran a totalitarian regime and the NGOs cooperated. They didn't say, we're not going to do this. They didn't say, we're going to pull out unless you stop doing this. They didn't say, we're not going to provide any aid that can possibly go for building terror tunnels or fishing equipment that ends up being used by the terrorist underwater commando group. These are all real things that have been documented clearly.
Are the NGOs complicit or coerced? Or both?
Yeah, I was going to say, what's the difference in the sense that they know?
There is a difference. So I think that what astounds me is that they are, for one reason or another, willing to compromise everything that they stand for morally and everything that they claim to stand for in the world for the opportunity to work within Gaza. Now, so I'm going to just sort of steal me on this argument. They see a need. There's something horrible going on in Gaza. It's very, very important to them to take care of these people. And so the only way to get there is to drop their pants to Hamas versus complicity, which is we invite Hamas in to be a part of the organization. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah, I'm seeing what you're saying. And it's one of those gray borders. But let's take the first, it's not cooperation. It's cooperation, not complicity. In other words, not voluntary. They don't go and say to Hamas, how much
coercion
do you want this week?
Yeah.
Yeah, coercion. Coercion can work up to, in other words, yes, they're being coerced. A lot of them are being coerced.
Mm-hmm.
But first of all, they broadly see Palestinians as universal victims. We're back to that post-colonial image, right? And okay, so there are a few bad eggs, bad apples. And that term sometimes gets used. So it's not so bad if we're coerced, but we're not going to make too much noise about being coerced. There are no red lines.
Literally? Is there literally no regulation of the NGO industry?
Literally, there, except for, there's things called charity commissions.
Yeah.
The IRS has 501c3 regulations. And
right.
But an NGO, an American NGO like Human Rights Watch, submits documents about its financial aspects, but it doesn't. There's nobody to regulate whether they violate the terms of their nonprofit status, which almost all of them do. There's nobody, and in most countries, it's much. IRS is particularly stringent, but in most countries, there's even less of an examination of where the money goes. And in the United States, there's beginning to be an examination, and in some cases, application of material support for terrorism, which mm-hmm. is a different set of mm-hmm. regulations.
Mm-hmm.
And some of this information may result. They might say, well, it wasn't our fault, we didn't know, but material support is still material support. So some members of Congress are beginning to look at this information. But in the vast parts of the world, in Germany, which gives a huge amount of international aid as part of their post-Holocaust attempt.
Reparations
in a certain sense.
Mm-hmm.
But there's nobody in the government that can tell you or knows how much international aid they give and how they give it, because it's very decentralized.
Mm-hmm.
So there's nobody in the federal government who monitors whether this organization that they're giving money to works with terrorists or not.
Is this unique to Gaza? I mean, do they do?
No, it's not unique to Gaza, but it is amplified. The same problem. Andrew Fox just did a paper for Henry Jackson Society, and it's actually quite parallel and work similar to the work that we did in different details, same basic approach on cash voucher assistance, CVA. British government gave, I don't remember how many, tens of millions or more than that. And they do it, and I think they had four or five case studies. One was Yemen with the Houthis, one was in Sudan, one was in Nigeria, and Gaza, and there may have been another one. They're almost all the same. Money is given blindly. I don't think in this case it's a matter of knowingly cooperating with terrorists. It's this that philosophy that there are people starving and we have to help them. And if the terrorists take 20, 50, whatever percent, that's the cost of doing business. That's that was that paper that in the introduction that Anne Hertzberger and I did. And they worried, what are they worried about? If it gets discovered, it'll hurt our reputation.
Ah, well,
that's their big
concern. We wouldn't want that to happen.
So, and that's the British government, which is even more, has, at least in theory, has more limitations than other European governments do in terms of blindly providing lots of money. It's a huge industry. You said these organizations look at Gaza and they say there are people starving, we need to help them. But they also know that if they don't go into Gaza, then their funding will be reduced, or the other way around. You go into Gaza, you're going to get huge gobs of money, some of which pays all your salaries and your benefits, some of which gives the organization its ability to influence policies, do PR and everything else. It's a whole process. I've forgotten there was I believe she's a Dutch author, and if I remember her name, I'll mention it, who did this in Africa. No connection with Israel, Gaza, anything else.
Yeah.
But she went, I think the aid caravan it's called.
Okay.
And now I just have to remember her name. It's been translated into a number of languages, including English. And they went in Central Africa, which is all these terrible wars, and they're all sustained by international aid, millions of people. And she traced, as a journalist, the way in which the NGOs fought each other and the international aid agencies like the UN, so that they would get more publicity, more visibility, more money. They didn't cooperate.
Okay.
There's an industry there, and it needs to be looked at as an industry, and it's so much money and so little oversight that all sorts of bad things can easily get into it. And you add to that the whole Palestinian embrace, all those victimization narratives, and that just increases it greatly. So what's happening in Gaza is not unique, but it is significantly amplified because it's Gaza, because it's Palestinians, and it's because the Jews are causing all the terrible things, the suffering in Gaza.
Of course.
So add those two together, you got a big story.
I'm curious though, do you feel like the NGO industry has been hijacked by the Islamist agenda? Is there like sort of like a pan-Islamic strategy that you're seeing across the globe? Or is, again, one thing about that's become very morally confusing, I think, for the world is pro-Israel versus, I'm going to say pro-Hamas. And the reason that I say this, and rather than pro-Gaza, pro-Palestinian, is because the pro-Israel community is not anti-Palestinian. In fact, most of them are very peaceful. The pro, name the thing, I'm going to say Hamas, is anti-Israel. So with an NGO, it seems like there might be a way for them to support in a neutral fashion both the needs of the Israelis, and that they could say what happened on 10/7 were atrocities, which almost none of them were willing to say. We want to attend to the horrors that happened there, and we also want to attend to this war-torn, whatever we call it, territory on the other side of the southern border. But they've chosen to become decidedly anti-Israel, and in many cases, anti-Western. Have the Islamists hijacked the entire industry, or do you mostly think that it's Gaza?
You put a lot of stuff on the table. Yeah. I'm going to try to disaggregate a little bit.
Okay.
Because the answer is no, not everything, okay. And not dominance.
Okay.
But certainly a significant factor. So let me break that down, yes, a little bit. Red Green Alliance, all of that, in some organizations, absolutely. In others, not at all. In others, it's just, you can see elements of it.
Okay.
And each one has got its own characteristics. There are a lot of groups. Let me start with the no part, and then the other stuff we sort of talked about. There are a lot of groups that do have, where you see the Islamic influence, where they or people who are part of that that framework. Amnesty International, is, to mm-hmm. some degree, Doctors Without Borders, among part of the leadership. If you look at the people and the names, you see that they come from that, but they're not mm-hmm. really the ones who determine. They got elected, not elected. They got selected as the faces running the organization. So you get elements of that in there. But let me go back a couple of steps on this. Again, we're talking about a huge, massive industry. So a lot of the groups that we talk about don't have that strong, it's more the red than the green. It's mm-hmm. more the anti-Western, mm-hmm. post-colonial, and the we got to help these poor suffering victims of colonialism and oppression and Israeli violence and genocide, and they're Palestinians, and maybe we'll help a few people in Sudan and elsewhere along the same way. So I think there that the things that we talked about before are the more dominant elements of it, not so much the green, meaning the Muslim or Arab elements to that. You don't see them that strong. You can look at parts of Oxfam, and you do see that. Mm-hmm. And some of them, and they drive that Gaza agenda, the Israel, the Middle East agenda. Mm-hmm. And I have talked to people, same thing with Doctors Without Borders, who have no connection. They're part of the organization, but they deal with other areas, or even UN agencies or the World Health Organization. They do other areas, and they're not infected with the anti-Israel stuff, but that's theirs. They say, we leave that to the professionals, the experts, the people, and those tend to be dominated. They capture. Mm-hmm. See, the mm-hmm. more I talk, I figure out the vocabulary. Because I really haven't been asked to address that specifically very often, but I think capturing is a good term there. That they carve out part of the organization. Then if somebody says, hey, you know, you really shouldn't be doing that. You shouldn't be giving help to Hamas and shouldn't be allowing the materials and the money to go to build tunnels. Hey, keep out of, this is my area. In fact, you're being, what's the term, Islamophobic by questioning my mm-hmm. my authority and my expertise mm-hmm. in this organization. And then you go all the way to the other side of the spectrum, and you have groups like Islamic Welfare Worldwide.
Yeah.
Or, Islamic Relief Worldwide, which is also a multi-billion-dollar-a-year organization. And by the way, it's very similar to Christian groups, World Vision. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. World Vision also had its head of its operation in Gaza was arrested and convicted for stealing. He was accused of stealing $50 million. Dollars. So they said, we didn't ever give that
Gaza?
Much money in Gaza over a period of 10 years. Yeah. And they kept claiming, no, this was Australian money. It's a long and complicated story. It shows you how much Hamas he was. First of all, the documents are there now. And the recording of what he did, the transcripts of everything he did. This is just one example, one $50 million example over 10 years. But he was, when the first exchange of hostages took place, mm-hmm. I think maybe a month or two after the October 7th, he was on the list of prisoners that Hamas demanded to be released.
Oh my gosh.
The head of World Vision Gaza.
Right.
$50 million provided by the Australian taxpayer.
Unbelievable.
And the Australian people who, this is the more the red part of the alliance, And they may have been completely naive and innocent and ignorant of the fact that the money was being stolen. But all they said was, it's all a setup. Israel is just trying to prevent Palestinians from getting this aid.
Of course.
Well, the evidence was so obviously black and white. So there are lots of examples, but they're all similar in the sense that I think it's a mix.
Right.
And each organization has to be looked at. And very often the structure of the organizations are incredibly convoluted.
Right.
You can't, a group like Oxfam or Amnesty to try to figure out how they make the decisions, how they choose their leaders. It's got so many layers in the finances. You've got a registered charity. First of all, you got branches in different countries which are independent, sort of independent financing, not necessarily in coordination. And then you have a secretary. You got all these complicated, in order to prevent anybody from the outside of actually understanding how it works.
Right.
And that makes it easy for some combination of red-green alliance to take over.
So they have these guarantors inside the organizations. Are they all high level? And does Hamas have the ultimate veto on all operations? Like how much control? I assume there's a spectrum. I assume that in some organizations, there's a guy in an office that is the eyes and the ears of Hamas. Then I assume, as you're saying, there are some people in the upper ranks who are. And I'm wondering also, are any of these guarantors, these Hamas operatives, operating beyond Gaza, or are they operating in Oxfam in London?
Okay,
or?
Let's break it down again.
Okay.
Don't put too many things on the table. First of all, in the case of the documents and the guarantors and Hamas and the NGOs, these are all they're all locals.
Yeah,
they're not so they only operate in Gaza.
Right.
Or they operated in Gaza, and they are not their position in the organization. Varies. There's not one level in which they all sit in. Also, I think it's important to say that we have some documents. The documents give us some information. Beyond that, there may be other layers, other factors that we don't know. There may be more than one guarantor. There may be other. We do have some transcripts, some discussions, meetings between government officials, not just NGOs. For instance, this goes back to the Brits and the reputation issue and the cash voucher assistance program, mm-hmm, which I've forgotten mm-hmm. how many million pounds the British government put into this and still putting in. Now, I think the Swedish government says, we're going to do the same thing. And we said, wait a minute, aren't you going to learn a little bit from the mistakes that were made here? And the money all ends up going to Hamas because Hamas decides who gets the money. And they had meetings, people, Hamas officials, the heads that were involved in, or I'm not sure the exact level, but of in what's called the Interior Ministry, which is, that's a form of secret police and other things. And they met with people who are identified as British consular officials who met them in Gaza and discuss the details. That's where we get the term, we're concerned about our reputation if this gets out. But discuss the details. The money actually went to UNICEF, and UNICEF gave it to the Hamas people, and the British government said, we just gave it to UNICEF. It's not our... And some of the money went to the Norwegian Refugee Council, did the same thing. There's enough... It's one of those... There's enough evidence, clearly, that they knew what was going on. The British government's response was, this guy wasn't really a diplomat. What does that mean? Okay, maybe he didn't have an office in Whitehall.
Okay.
But you didn't say that he doesn't work for the British government and had no connection with the British government. And then we would have said, or journalists would have said, so why is, or members of parliament is a more accurate term, why is that person represented as a British government official in the documents? But the denial, he's not a diplomat and therefore it's not our issue, it's just... attempting to whitewash and prevent a serious investigation. So, this is an example. You could say it's coercion, but it's ignorance, willful ignorance.
Okay.
We don't ask questions, and then we'll have plausible deniability, so our reputation, which is going to get damaged anyway when this stuff comes out. So.
Mm-hmm. Plausible deniability is exactly the question I was going to ask
Except it stops being
you.
Plausible.
Yeah, exactly. It seems like the only place that I would say that plausible deniability may actually play a role is the fact that Hamas is so deeply embedded in all aspects of Gazan civilization.
Yes.
That there is no Gaza without Hamas, nor is there any Hamas without Gaza.
Now that's, yes.
And so
since 2007, yeah.
Yeah, with such a vast infiltration, the question is, would if they wanted workers, employees within Gaza that weren't a part of Hamas, do they even exist?
Look,
on some level,
if you, I think it's hard to say convincingly that everybody in Gaza is Hamas.
Well, yeah.
And they have a lot of control over that. But then you have to adjust your policies accordingly.
Yeah,
and that's complicated. And one of the excuses that we sometimes get is it costs money. We got to hire people who can sort through, decide who should get cash and who shouldn't get cash. Mm-hmm. Somebody who will monitor the use of concrete. Or flour, or all sorts of other things that we bring in. We just want to give the money and get out, mm-hmm. or give the goods and get out, the aid and get out, which is incredibly irresponsible in a zone, in an area that's controlled by a terrorist organization, a terror regime. You're not helping anybody. In fact, you're entrenching the Hamas control. So you have to come up with different methods. One of the things that I have said to many people who do, those people who from organizations who do talk to us, and they do, especially if they think they're going to get burned, so they should at least find out a little bit more. And some people who really are concerned about this, I want to mm-hmm. make that clear. It's not, everybody's not all evil. I've had meetings with people who come very frustrated by the fact that the people above them don't want to take these basic steps. You got to devote at least 10% of your budget if you're doing aid. 10% of it's got to be to monitoring. That's the absolute minimum. You got to use the technology. You got to have the personnel. You can't be in a position of not knowing where your funding, where your money goes, where your goods go. Mm-hmm. And certainly for the Israeli government to say, these are the rules. Mm-hmm. We didn't have any rules before. Since mm-hmm. 1967, mm-hmm. every humanitarian aid agency that had been working under the Jordanians before 67 got an automatic permit, visa, open right. door. That's ended. We have registration now. NGOs that provide aid have to register, and they have to provide the minimum that, so we can monitor, because you're not going to monitor. So let us, we're going to monitor whether there's terrorists involved. And the different levels, too. So in terms of the Hamas people who are involved.
Is that due to your work? I mean, it seems like it was after this report that all of a sudden all this stuff about people, I know you got to go.
Go ahead.
That's like the secret symbol.
No, it's not. I did have to check it. I did have to check it.
That's okay. How many minutes? Tell me.
We got five. If you need a little bit more, we can do longer.
Okay. Because my whole shtick is I talk until I get kicked out.
Okay. Now you tell me. I'm not going to kick you out. Let's do a couple more things and then we'll see if we can.
I laugh because when I was talking to Jonathan Conricus, like he's talking and he literally wrote last question and he like pushed it over to me and he's just talking. And
you used to mention Jonathan Conricus. In fact, a lot of people that you've interviewed lately on these issues. So that it gets the question you asked me.
Okay.
Because it didn't happen overnight. Yeah. The Israeli, I have been talking to people, not always, not usually, not only at my initiative, in positions in the Israeli structure, and that means also academics, I give conference presentations, and members of parliament, members of Knesset and government, for 10 years, mm-hmm. roughly. Look, mm-hmm. we've been around for 25 years.
Yeah.
So about sort of 10 years ago or so, it was enough of an issue is after roughly after the 2014 Gaza War, mm-hmm. which was, I think it was 52 days, and it was quite extensive. And again, mm-hmm. the issue of destruction and aid and NGOs became an issue. Also, I have met with numerous American government officials, ambassadors, almost all the American ambassadors probably for the last 20 years on this issue.
Okay.
So it's not just, this came about, the Israeli government officials began to realize many years ago that they needed a different system. It took a while to develop, and then it became absolutely necessary after October 7th. Mm-hmm. Not because of these documents. These documents were only discovered and revealed and published in the last few months.
Right.
Now, the documents help make the case stronger, but the NGOs have, I think, a more difficult time justifying non-cooperation in the wake of these documents. And you get the stupidest responses. How do we know these documents are genuine? Which basically says NGO Monitor and some secretive Israeli security people spent the time fabricating hundreds of protocols and then deleting the names of the people, right? So that nobody would lose their lives because they were revealed to have been cooperating, whatever it is in part of this. We respect privacy even of people who work with Hamas. That in any case, the point is that this is a process that should have been done earlier. It's being done now, and the website in English. You want to register to provide humanitarian aid anywhere, West Bank, Gaza, Israel, and coming back to balance. Remind me to come back to that issue too. You know, we should work with both.
Yes.
But you want to provide humanitarian aid. You want to get visas for your people. You want to be able to bring in equipment and obviously the aid itself. Here's a form to fill out. The form has a number of categories, one of which, one that gets the greatest amount of attention. And the forms are available online. Anybody can read them. They're easily found. And they're in English again. They're not in Hebrew. Is names of the staff members.
Should be pretty low-hanging fruit, yes.
And they, when an organization like Doctors Without Borders or Norwegian Refugee Council says, no, we're not going to give you the names, you're not going to check them to see if there's terrorists, and you're not going to let us check them to see if they're terrorists. How do you expect to operate in an environment where we have these people who have been obviously stealing massive amounts of aid and using it for terrorism? We don't want to deal with that. That's basically what they're saying. We refuse to recognize that as an issue. So this has been discussed, percolating, as I said, for many years.
Yeah.
I want to answer another question you
asked
me.
The balance thing.
The balance thing. That's a tough one. This one is easy because I think it's anybody who looks at the details says, oh, that makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
You got to register. And the registration requires providing information.
Yeah, and yet, so I'm sorry, let me just note that as of January 1st, which was just a few days ago, 15% of all the NGOs can no longer operate in Gaza because they refuse to comply with these new regulations. But once again, the world is vilifying Israel for this.
So this is a whole machine that's out there.
It doesn't stop.
Yeah, because I read the New York Times article, which actually I expected worse.
Okay.
But it did not mention and include the criteria in it. I don't know if the reporter even bothered to look at the registration forms to be able to say, oh, these are the things.
Reasonable questions.
They quoted the NGOs with all the attacks, which most of which were just PR or propaganda.
Mm-hmm.
And they quoted the Israeli government response, and that was the end of it.
Right.
And that became a major, and it's all over the media because the NGOs are all pushing it. Why did the New York Times run the thing? Because, and I use the Times because that's the newspaper of record. They do not take this issue seriously. Journalists still largely ignore or attribute the work, including the work of NGO Monitor, to an Israeli lobby, to an Israeli conspiracy.
Mm-hmm.
They don't look independently at the information. So there is a big campaign because the NGOs don't want to do this, and they think, oh, and they're right. If the Israelis do this, other countries are going to do this. We're going to lose a lot of the curtain behind which we operate in the Wizard of Oz is going to be removed from us. We don't want that to happen. We've been getting away with not doing that for decades. So Oxfam is another one. Nope, that's it. You're not going to do that anymore. You're a big business. You have a lot of strategic implications by the operations that you run. You're not going to, in our sovereign territory, the territory that we control, you are not going to be able to act as if there is absolutely no government and no regulations.
Okay. So to round this off, because I know it's a work day for you, and I deeply appreciate your allowing me to come in.
Good questions, and they need to be, I at least try to answer them.
These are great answers, and just because I just threw you off because you said you wanted to answer the balance thing. So let's go back to that. And then point. I asked a weird whatever.
Let's go back to the point about the balance. That NGOs that could say, okay, we're going to work with the Palestinians or suffering, we're going to work with the Israelis.
Yeah.
There are a couple of sort of structural issues with that. Israeli society doesn't need humanitarian aid and doesn't want international humanitarian aid. We're not dependent. That's a very important part of
being. I agree, but there's something to be said for recognition. I mean, a lot of these organizations are literally denying that they're denying that the atrocities happened. So I understand that Israel does not need the physical aid, but there's something to be said for just neutrality on humanitarian issues.
There was once upon a time, I met with members of Doctors Without Borders, officials from, I believe, from Switzerland, who had just come here and agreed to have a meeting or may have even initiated the meeting. And we talked about people they should be meeting with because they were based in Gaza. So they had no contact with Israeli society. But that group, it was like two or three people, they knew that they needed that. Mm-hmm. So you don't have to work and provide aid in order on a regular basis to meet with Israelis who are involved in this group called IsraAid and other groups like that.
Yeah.
And they provide assistance. So talk to people who are in the humanitarian aid realm, who therefore are peers and counterparts, but they're Israelis. And they're not people who say, oh, yeah, we're guilty of genocide. And sometimes somebody will say, oh, yeah, we met with B'Tselem and breaking the silence. And, okay, you want to meet with your echo chamber,
right,
who are funded largely by European groups, and many of them are churches who are anti-Semitic. That doesn't qualify. So, yes, that is an important issue, but it's very asymmetric. And the Israelis will never be seen, even after the worst unimaginable massacres and slaughters. You notice nobody's talking about all the Israeli orphans, all the kids who saw their parents slaughtered the most vile ways. I don't see any media efforts to say, well, what's...
Right.
Maybe these people... again, Israelis are not going to push it because we don't want to be seen as
victims,
yes. Yeah, as that was a different era. We are independent, stand on our own feet.
At the same time,
you need to, yes,
Israel, like even America. I mean, America, with the wealthiest nation on earth, we still need charities. We still need so if nothing else, I mean, we have a whole nation here that they're saying 30% are suffering from PTSD. If nothing else, there's soft aid that could be offered, such as, counseling. But there are people who are hungry in Israel, and Israel is stretched thin, and Israel does have to fight wars on whatever, 8 fronts, 7 kinetic and 1 propaganda. And the money doesn't just come out of nowhere. And now Israel, for other reasons, has to become militarily independent. And so it wouldn't kill us if Oxfam said, yes, I also want to take care of Israeli orphans.
I'm not sure that would work well because Oxfam is Oxfam. And has
or whatever. But, I fill in the blank.
But there are, that's a discussion that needs to be had and mechanisms can be found. Work with Israelis who are doing that. Give them support.
Yes.
And whatever, so it's not Oxfam coming in and saying, "Oh, we've been saying Israel commits genocide and starvation, and now we're going to take on some Israeli victims to show that we're okay." There were the British government, the British Jewish community tried to do a program with Oxfam, sort of like that would be try to bring Oxfam into understanding at least the Israeli side, and it just was a disaster.
Right,
it was a complete failure. Because the image that they consist, right, the people that came in from Oxfam just couldn't make that, cut that bridge. And that's a very hard bridge to cross.
Yeah.
And I'm not saying it shouldn't be done, but let's not trivialize it's not just a matter of, okay, we're going to have a resolution, we're going to sign a little bit of money and some people to do that, and we'll check that box.
Yeah.
It's got to be much deeper than that. And that requires really a change in of all the things that we talked about.
I think somebody came up with the name that you were looking for. Is it Linda Pullman?
Yes, thank you. It definitely is.
And it came with the super chat, which was very nice.
I see. I'm not sitting here checking things.
Well, I just saw something popping up over there, and I'm like, I can't read that far.
It is Linda Pullman, yes.
But I can read over here. Okay, so your report.
Thank you.
Your report is actually linked in the show notes, so anybody can see it. And I also highly recommend that everybody go to the NGO Monitor site. It is a there is a vast plethora of information, not just on NGOs. Well, let me ask you, do you consider the UN an NGO?
No, we just do NGOs.
No, you don't. You have an UNRWA report in there.
We do have a UNICEF report. We do it because they work together.
Right.
So in areas where they work together, you're absolutely right.
Okay.
UNRWA and UNICEF, again, the British government through NGOs gave money that was laundered by UNICEF and then given to the Hamas to decide who the needy Palestinian families to get it. So yes, you're right. That is true. But our primary mission, which makes us unique, is that we focus on NGOs, and we have a listing on our website, a database of about 300, which provides more than anything anybody'd ever want to know about each of the NGOs and the campaigns and what they do. And then, yes, you're right, when it gets to UN-related issues that where there's
inextricable link.
Yeah, exactly. That's a good, exactly right term. Mm-hmm. There are other work groups that we work with as well. UN Watch does a very good job, and I am the UN and monitoring the UN. We work together with them.
Oh, okay.
Just as we work together with media groups, Camera Honest Reporting, because when the journalists write about the wonders of these NGOs and they are as experts on everything, and it turns out A, they're not wonderful, and B, they're not experts,
right?
Then groups that monitor media then become involved. So we partner because we're one piece of a very complicated puzzle.
Right.
And we know we stay in our lane
because
there's more than enough to do. And I think that provides the expertise.
Yeah.
I'll just end by saying that because we started, we discussed at the beginning what led me to found NGO Monitor to start working in this area. It is, at the time, I was, I won't say shocked, but surprised that there was no such organization. After Durban, who's watching NGOs? Nobody. They're just, everybody, they're just wonderful expert, all this other stuff. Here we are, it's almost 25 years later. There's still no version of NGO Monitor out there. And as much as I think I'm very proud of the group, the people that we work with and everything else, it's such a huge industry that I think each there should be many more groups that we're research. We're a research institute. That's our official name, the Institute for NGO Research. And in Israel, that's how we're registered. And that needs to be, I think, a model, just as there are different groups monitoring media, NGOs. And I think that might be happening now. I see much more interest in that.
Do you only monitor NGOs how they relate to Israel, or
another good question. We have tried in the past.
You're like, I'm going to be here for the rest
of
my life.
No, it's going to be short answer.
I've got nothing but time.
The short answer is essentially yes, we only monitor because there are so many and so much work to
do.
We did try to devote 20% of our staff time, and we wrote a couple of reports about NGOs elsewhere. Humanitarian, political, human rights, even environment. Once I was consulted in terms of verbally asked about some corruption scandal in Greenpeace. And it's not hard to get the information, but the bottom line is it just takes us too far. We thought that by now we would be able to do a lot more of the broader NGO industry. But here we are.
Yeah. Interesting. So maybe we need NGO monitors for different sectors. I have to let you go only because I've already taken more of your time than you offered. And I'm very...
By agreement.
Thank you. Can you just tell us, it's in the show notes, but why don't you tell people where they could find you? Where would you say are the most accessible? Like some people like reports, some people like Instagram, short, like where would you...
Everywhere.
In everywhere. The sense
like
okay,
like
and
other
bye.
21st century organizations. I don't necessarily do that. Again, we have great people who do the Instagram reels. And we YouTube, when we do anything that's YouTubeable, we do that. And we do podcasts. Olga Deutsch, our vice president, does regular podcast series. And we're active on X, Twitter, all those things. And actually, if you go to our website, which is NGO-monitor.org, www at the beginning, then you get a menu.
Right.
And we get a bunch of headlines, the latest stuff we have, and then there's a menu. And we also, on the side, you can, I think, easily see all of the links to mm-hmm. each of the social media. So yeah, if you want reels, you can get reels. If you want longer, boring reports under publications, it's hopefully all there. And then there is the database in the middle, A to Z, both the NGOs, about 300, and the countries and donors, because the money is so essential.
Yep.
The fact that they got these billions of dollars gives them the power without the checks and balances of politics, as badly as they may be working, or in the corporate world, where at least there is some competition and oversight.
Yeah.
NGOs don't have that, and that's a big part of the problem.
And just to circle back to where we started, the main message also is it's not just pertaining to Gaza, but think before you give. Mm. Again, like with my yoga athletic causes, it doesn't matter if I was saving dogs, if I was saving Ukraine, if I was saving Turkey from a flood, if I'm saving orphans from a fire. No matter where these organizations with the nicest names care, you know, like they don't care. And you need to, at least when you're picking your charities, and I found out about Habitat for Humanity, about Doctors Without Borders. I mean, back in the 90s, like since I was old enough to understand all this stuff. And so organizations that I am morally inclined to support, I cannot give them a dollar of my money. And I'll tell you something interesting, Gerald. I have actually, when I was choosing my charities for my fundraisers, I would actually call organizations because I couldn't find any that were not anti-Israel. And I would literally tell them, I'm like, I'm doing a fundraiser. It will raise about $10,000. That's how much they each raised. And I want you to know that I am not including you because you have an anti-Israel bias. And they would say, what are you talking about?
It's right. They may not even know.
They don't know. Yeah. Even if they know their position, they don't. And I would read them. I would be like, okay, so you can't even say Israel without saying the word occupied. You can't talk about Gaza without saying the word apartheid.
Or genocide.
Like, yeah. Or genocide. All the ides. Right.
Yeah.
And I'm like, these are all lies. These are biases. This is not objective, you know. And so that's the interesting thing, is that they don't even understand how loaded.
That's the halo effect, that they believe their own.
Right. But they don't understand.
They're starting to, because it's starting to cost them.
Yes.
And people like you who do that, who say, I'm going to do the due diligence.
Mm-hmm.
I have to say that too many times.
Yeah.
And I'm going to check this before I give money.
Yeah.
And there's been some relatively wealthy people who I have sat with who had asked me first and said, I'm not going to give it. And
think before you give. Like, since 10/7, I'm so repulsed. I feel like I can't give money to anybody who's not an Israeli organization, to tell you the truth. It's very uncomfortable.
It's hard. People ask me organizations which are not tainted. It's very hard because it's just viral.
Yep.
And they all get up on the stage and see the others and they just follow through.
Yep.
Okay.
Yep. I have one last question because it's short, it's fast, and everyone gets asked it. What does Am Yisrael Chai mean to you?
It means I'm here. My family's here. My people are here. My life is here. Everything is here. We're not going anywhere.
Yeah.
Get used to it.
Amen. Thank you so much for your time. This has been an incredible conversation. I really, really deeply appreciate it. And Am Yisrael Chai.
Thank you very, very much for everything you do.
Thank you for tuning in.
Upgrade your tool storage for the new year with help from Menards. For heavy-duty storage that protects your tools, choose MasterForce. From shelving units to cabinets and so much more, you can keep your tools safe and within reach. Get versatile and durable storage from MasterForce today. Check out all our MasterForce storage in-store or check out our weekly flyer on Menards.com for all the great deals happening now. Save big.